Prime Time Replay from Money FM 89.3.
Well, 1 year ago this day was an especially exciting day in Malaysia, where the country voted for a new party, breaking the incumbent Barisan Nasional's 61-year rule and ousting former Prime Minister Najib Razak, who is now facing corruption trials related to troubled sovereign wealth fund 1MDB. The new Pakatan Harapan government, led by Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, swept to power with the promise of a new and corruption-free Malaysia. Now, 1 year on, how things change, and has Pakatan Harapan carried out its promises? Well, joining us to tell us more is Dr. Francis Hutchinson, a senior fellow and coordinator of the Malaysia Studies Program at the ISIS Yusof Ishak Institute. Well, Dr. Francis, 1 year after the historic win, how has the mood in Malaysia changed?
Well, certainly the mood has become more realistic and, if you like, indifferent. But this is to be expected. I mean, we had an administration that came into power on a platform of change. The thing is that change means different things to different people. People are expecting different changes. And the other thing is that, you know, we had a period of a lot of quick wins, a lot of changes in legislation, changes in leadership of key institutions in the country. But these are relatively easy to do if you have political will. Now we're in a more difficult period when, once the euphoria has passed, this government needs to start thinking about a narrative and a vision that it can articulate for people to look forward.
Do you think that Najib's fall and the ongoing corruption trial has buttressed voters' sense that they made the right choice, or do you think voters are losing faith?
Well, I think they're two different things. So the first thing is, again, I think we do have to give the new administration credit. And in many ways, perhaps they're being too nice, because this is someone that has 42 charges against him. And this is not even beginning to look at other things that happened supposedly when he was Minister of Defense. So this is someone that is walking around, is free. And, you know, we also have to take into account that they're being very, very careful, the new administration, because when they want that, when the trials are over, they want these charges to stick. So they don't want them to be overturned on a technicality. Consequently, we're really only just beginning to find out about the scale of the corruption that went on. These things are only really just beginning to come out now. So if you like, this will be going on for a long time, and we will continue to find out more. So that is with regards to Najib. But this touches on a deeper issue, and that is, you know, was their election win based on anti-Najib, or was it based on a clear vision? And then I think that's kind of where we are now, when, yes, Najib is being taken care of, but what's next?
Well, shortly after Pakatan Harapan claimed victory during last year's election, Dr. Mahathir has hinted a three-year maximum stay as Malaysian Prime Minister. Well, one burning question for many observers is when, or even whether, Mr. Anwar would take over from Dr. Mahathir. What's your personal take on this, and why hasn't it happened yet?
Well, okay, it hasn't happened yet because we haven't sort of got to the two-year time frame. So actually, it was 2 years at the outset, and you can see that there's a bit of slippage now that it's going to 3 years. So my take is that it will happen, and that is because, more than anything else, it has to do with the legacy that Dr. Mahathir would like to leave behind. So his first administration, his first 22 years in power, which of course is a long time, was very much about, you know, Malaysia as an Asian tiger, the country growing very quickly, acquiring technological capabilities, producing cars, so on and so forth. And, you know, by and large, of course, with some missteps, he can look back at that as, you know, having delivered a certainly very, very consistent economic growth. Now what he's come back to do is really sort of clean up house and restore the country's institutions and reestablish its democracy. And I think that if he does not follow through on this promise, very much it will be seen as tarnishing his legacy. So that, I think, will happen. Now the question is, when? Because whenever people ask him, he always says two things. He says, number one, he will hand over power to Anwar. But number two, he will stay as long as people want him. And so, you know, how long do people want him? And that is a little bit arbitrary. So that is why I think we're beginning to see a bit of a slippage from the two-year mark more towards the three-year mark.
Yeah, just picking up on that, Dr. Mahathir being an interim prime minister, which is something he himself has said, there have been rumours that Dr. Mahathir may actually favour passing the baton to former aide Azmin Ali, also Malaysia's economic affairs minister. Now, if this comes to pass, Azmin Ali chosen, is this something that the Malaysian electorate can accept?
Well, there are, of course, rumours, but I still think that the handover to Anwar is more likely. Now, if it doesn't happen and it does go to Azmin, it really is going to be a discussion less about Azmin, and it's more going to be about why is it not going to Anwar. And that will be, you know, really very much based on the merit of the reasons of why it's not going to Anwar. So I don't think Azmin is that much of a central figure yet.
We're joined by Dr. Francis Hutchinson, Senior Fellow and Coordinator of the Malaysia Studies Program at the ISIS Yusof Ishak Institute, as we discuss how Malaysia is doing 1 year ago today. It was such an exciting time as the country voted in a new party. Okay, if we move on to Mr. Anwar's daughter, Nurul Iza, several weeks ago, she called Dr. Mahathir a former dictator, saying her heart had been broken somewhat in the past year. That led Anwar to come forward and say the family supports Dr. Mahathir. What do you make of that whole episode? And do you think that Dr. Mahathir's leadership style has changed from when he was prime minister the first time?
Okay, so I think that there are like two little questions there. So the first one has to do with Nurul Iza. And so politics is a difficult business. And the coming together of the Pakatan Harapan coalition was really, really difficult for people in PKR and DAP that had a long history of opposing Mahathir. And this was even more the case of Nurul Iza because, of course, you know, Anwar Ibrahim is her father, and so she very, very much lived, you know, him is going to prison, particularly, you know, after the Asian financial crisis, it was very, very difficult for her. But this is the nature of politics, and, you know, there are moments in history when pragmatism has to take precedence over feelings, and this can be bad, but it can also be good, as we see in the case of South Africa, which, you know, managed a very successful transition away from apartheid. So, you know, it's good and bad, and we can understand how difficult it is for her. Now, if we look in terms of leadership, certainly, you know, you read his autobiography, you read his writings. He is someone that has very, very fixed ideas over certain things on how to handle the economy, you know, the position of Malays, affirmative action, technology, where he wants Malaysia to go, and also how to be a leader. In addition, we have to keep in mind that he is someone that is extremely busy and doesn't have time to assimilate lots of new information because he's always working. Plus, we also must remember that a lot of the people in cabinet are young, and this is in part a response to the political environment that he helped to create himself. So consequently, we see him having to take quite an outsized role. And take a lot of decisions himself and be very, very much at the forefront. So I think he is being very much the person he always has been in a slightly different context.
Okay, when the Pakatan Harapan government first swept to power, well, they made sure to fulfill certain election promises, I mean, including abolishing the GST, reviewing the mega rail projects, but several other promises remain open-ended for now. 100 days after Pakatan Harapan won the election, Dr. Mahathir told the Straits Times here in the interview that they made those promises without expecting to win. Now, does this mean that some of the election promises remain impractical and perhaps would never be carried out?
Okay, so certainly Mahathir and other senior leaders have admitted that they did not expect to win. And to be fair, they are certainly not going to be the first administration elected on the basis of campaign promises that are difficult to fulfill. But we must break the reasons as to why they can't fulfill these promises down into two. So the first is we must recognize that the finances of the previous government, the Najib Razak administration, were a mess. And they inherited more than ₱1 trillion of debt. So very, very difficult and financially quite constrained. But certainly also there were promises that they made, such as abolishing tolls on toll roads that are very expensive and not feasible to implement. So, for example, to abolish tolls would take 130 billion ringgit of investment to buy back highways from public, from private companies. And this is so expensive. To put that into context, this renegotiated price for the East Coast Rail Link is 45 billion ringgit. So it takes three times the amount of capital to basically honor one campaign promise. So certainly there were a number of things that are very, very difficult to fulfill.
Even though Pakatan Harapan carried out its promise to review the mega projects like the KL Singapore High Speed Rail, the East Coast Rail Link project with China, do you think it's done so at the jeopardy of its credibility? After all, we've seen investor confidence dwindle. Moody's Investor Service has cut Malaysia's 2019 gross domestic product growth forecast to 4.4% from a high of 4.7% projected in January. Has its international reputation taken a hit because of its review of these mega projects?
No, I don't think so. Let's look at some of these mega projects. Some of them, you know, did not make and still don't make a lot of sense. So we have the East Coast Rail Link, you know, which goes from the west coast of the peninsula across to Kuantan on the east coast. Okay, maybe that makes some sense, but then from there it goes through a part of the country with very, very few people. So you're not going to have enough people taking the train for it to make money. And because of the way it's configured, in order to ship freight, maybe you'd have a lot of things going from Kuala Lumpur outwards, but you wouldn't have things coming back the other way, so making it very expensive and very difficult to ship freight. But already it had been negotiated and payments had been underway, and it was very, very overpriced. So what the new government has done is come in, really review, and send someone very senior like Daim to go and negotiate with the Chinese leaders and come back and bring down the price from 65 billion ringgit to 44 billion ringgit and also revisit the ownership structure so not all of the risk is borne by Malaysia. So if you ask me, this actually shows an attention to detail, a knowledge of how infrastructure projects should be structured, but also a willingness to compromise with a very large partner, an economic partner like China, which is Malaysia's largest trading partner. So no, I would think if you look at the specifics, what they're doing is very reasonable and fiscally and financially responsible.
Well, we know that billions of foreign funds have been flowing out of the stock exchange and from bonds as well. And the private sector spending has also eased. Well, Dr. Mahathir said last month that the country has no money and has been stolen. In your opinion, how has the Malaysian economy performed under Pakatan Harapan?
Well, again, we must remember that it is early days, but I'd say a couple of things. So the first thing is that, yes, they've eliminated the GST and put in SST. The second thing that they've done is begun in a measured fashion, not in a very radical fashion, because it would be very difficult to implement, is increase the minimum wage. And the third thing that they've done is put in a levy on foreign workers that becomes more difficult to pay the more foreign workers you employ. So similarly, it doesn't make it so difficult for SMEs to employ foreign workers. So I think that this is quite measured. Now, for it to begin to do more things, it needs to, and this comes back to what I was earlier saying, generate a vision for the country, and it also needs to begin to start looking at some of the philosophical questions that, you know, some of the differences that the different coalition partners may have. And it needs to do things like, you know, have more scientists and technicians in universities, have a different R&D culture where you have made better exchange between companies and universities. And you also need to address this foreign worker issue. So these things will take 5, 10, 15 years. And are very, very difficult. And, you know, also Malaysia is at a level of income where it cannot expect to be growing so quickly. It is an upper middle income country. So it cannot be growing at, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10% a year. Those days are behind it. And now it's much more difficult and it will involve longer and deeper, more systemic issues.
racial politics still very much in the mix. UMNO and Parti Islam Semalaysia have used racial politics to hit back at PH, and some have said the party hasn't quite won over Malay voters who have said that the PH has not done enough to defend their rights. So when it comes to opinion polls that do show that Chinese and Indians are getting impatient with what's been described as the slow pace of reforms, what options do you think the PH has in this area?
So, I mean, I think there are a couple of things. So the first thing is, again, we need, and we're not hearing that in part because I think that the government is a little bit too inward looking. So we need to start hearing over the next 1, 2, 3 years what are going to be the priorities that this government is going to look at. So that's one in terms of generating quick wins for people. But the second thing, and this has to do with UMNO particularly, and to a lesser extent PAS, you know, are they being a responsible opposition or are they seeking to gain points in a short-term perspective? And very much, I would think, given the leadership of UMNO right now, we missed an opportunity last year to have a different type of leader in UMNO, perhaps someone like Khairil Jamaluddin or perhaps someone like Khaled Nordin, that would take the party in a different direction. What we're seeing now is very much the old guard in the party and one that is, you know, I would say, seeking to stir up issues without really looking at the long-term potential for the country.
Well, in the past year, Singapore and Malaysia relations have seen ups and downs. And as Dr. Mahathir has at times seen anti-Beijing as well in his comments, and the East Coast Rail Link project was close to being cancelled because of the high cost. How do you think Malaysia's relations with other countries have changed under the Pakatan Harapan leadership?
Number one, as I think we just discussed a few minutes ago, I think China went through a period of questioning, largely to do with the type and the quantum and the nature of investments from China in Malaysia. I think that a lot of the hard work, a lot of the behind-the-scenes work has been done. So now we have a new agreement for the ECRL. We have agreements to buy palm oil. So I would think that the shall we say, turbulent period or uncertain period, I think is a better word, between the two countries is now behind. Now, with regards to Singapore, I think that we have, if you like, an upper threshold and a lower threshold on relationships between the two countries. You have a lower threshold because these are neighboring countries and any neighboring countries are bound because of the proximity to have issues. So that will, you know, they're always going to be pending issues for the two countries to deal with. On the upper threshold, we always know that, you know, because of the proximity, because of the fact that each is the other's second largest trading partner, because Singapore gets its water, it gets its fruit, it gets its fish from Malaysia and vice versa. We have 200,000 to 300,000 Malaysians coming across into Singapore every day to work. There's an upper threshold because these two countries need each other. Now, we do currently have a discussion on water, partly because of climate reasons. It's been raining less in Johor, partly because there are water management issues in terms of leakages and some pollution, and also because, you know, Johor has sold water to other states in Malaysia at a higher price. Conversely, of course, Singapore does sell treated water at a subsidized price to Johor. But this is an issue. And if you look at Mahathir's writings and the way he talks, this is very much an issue that he has been bringing up for a long period. But then we have other things that come up like maritime issues and borders and the airport management. And largely, I think that when you have discussions and issues between the two countries, you always have a variety of issues that come up. In part, this is a negotiating strategy that both countries have because you can give a little bit on one area and then take back on another. So that's why we tend to see relationships between these two countries centered around clusters of issues.
Thank you so much for joining us. That's Dr. Francis Hutchinson speaking to us. 1 year ago was the day of a stunning election defeat over in Malaysia. Dr. Francis Hutchinson is Senior Fellow and Coordinator of the Malaysia Studies Program at the ISIS Yusof Ishak Institute.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.